Want complete protection? Try PhytoGuard, the ultimate nutraceutical combo, a great blend of all the top phytonutrients. I developed it, and it's exclusively available at drhoffman.com. Check it out. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, on a holiday week. I hope you're all having a great holiday, whatever you're celebrating or not celebrating, whether it be Passover, Easter, Good Friday. A lot of people are taking it easy a little bit this week, varying from the usual routine, seeing friends and family members. It's spring break. And today with us, of course, Hoffman Center nutritionist, Layla Mudin. Hi, Layla. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Great. How are you?
Good. And for our listening audience, those few of you who are not familiar with our Q&A with Layla podcast, each week we endeavor to answer listener questions. So the both of us put our heads together, as we do each day at the Hoffman Center, using a team approach to solve patients' problems. And today is no exception. The way you can get questions to us is via radioprogram@AOL.com, one-word radioprogram@AOL.com. And if you have a question, you can send it to us, and we'll answer as many of your questions as we can on Q&A with Layla. So, interestingly, this morning, you know, we've been talking about how cold it was this winter and announcing that spring has finally sprung and winter is behind us. But lo and behold, to our amazement...
It's not.
To our amazement this morning, what was the temperature on your way to work this morning?
Oh, about 30 degrees with the wind chill. It feels like 19 or...
Yeah. So it was instant, it was instant December. And what did
you say?
I thought
I was able to put away the Nanook hat for good, but no, I had to take it back out this morning.
You said something to me this morning when I first came in the office, and it was a little too early in the morning, and I just looked at you like, what? What did you say to me? You said something, did you get the memo?
Yes, did you get the memo? Summer's not coming this year.
And I was afraid. I was thinking, like, did we get a memo from a patient? I was like, okay. So anyway, temporarily spring is on hold, and I feel sorry for all the people who put their plants outside last night.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
There's that, right.
So we got sucker punched once again, and there were cars actually with snow hanging off them.
There's snow in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
In Sunnyside. There's snow on the cars. I'm in my galoshes this morning.
And yes. In the building next door to us, there's actually a little plaza where people can sit outside and sun themselves, amazingly, some open space in Manhattan. And they don't have real grass there. They have AstroTurf. But when you look out the window, the AstroTurf is white this morning. So
April 16th. Oh,
exactly. All right. So... here's a nice item from one of our listeners. Marie writes, "Dear Dr. Hoffman, for the past several years, I have been downloading your podcasts and listening to every one of them."
Wow.
And this is the cool part. "I am 70 years old, so we have a tech-savvy 70-year-old, and haven't needed to contact you for any issues yet, but it's comforting to know where you are when I need you. And to Marie, I say, I hope you don't need me for a really, really long time."
How wonderful. Wow.
Yeah. So I think that really attests to the fact that there's a lot of self-care out there via the information that we get across. I also had a very nice meeting with a new patient this morning who said that she managed to cure her Crohn's disease back in 1992 because she was listening to the radio, and simultaneously her husband was listening to the radio. They were in two different places. And immediately after the radio show, they called each other, and they're very excited. They said, well, this sounds great. Let's try this diet. And ultimately, her Crohn's disease resolved for many, many years. That was just exciting to be able to get the word out to people.
Absolutely.
So know that you are making a big difference. We are making a big difference in the lives of many of the folks who listen to our podcasts. Now, before we get to our questions, I just want to share with you an amazing headline from the Wall Street Journal this morning. Caught my attention. Headline, "More people pick elimination diets to discover food sensitivities." And I say, duh, And this is what was interesting, because there's always like a latency period between the time that we talk about certain ideas, you know, whether it be fish oil or hypoglycemia or insulin resistance or the importance of vitamin D, and the time that it gets picked up by big media. Usually that period of time, maybe 5, 10, 15 years. In this case, I think it's like 30 years, because I think just about from the very beginning of my practice of complementary and alternative medicine in the mid to late 1980s, we were very aware of the role that food might play, and elimination diets are important.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know why it's not more mainstream, really. And, you know, you could do it yourself. You could do it at home. You know?
Exactly. And it says, the idea behind these elimination diets is to help people identify more subtle, gradual reactions to common food groups such as dairy, soy, nuts, eggs, gluten, sugar, and alcohol. They completely avoid those foods for a few weeks. And they say there's little science to prove specific cause and effect behind this style of eating. But lots of people report feeling significantly better.
Yeah. <laughs> So, remarkably so. And, you know, it's
another
route for somebody who doesn't want to go to a doctor, do a lot of testing, who just, you know, would rather embark upon it themselves. The usual suspects are frequently the foods that we crave most, for one thing, and the foods that you just have a hunch about. You know, I feel sleepy after I eat this, but not after I eat that, you know. It's a way to kind of figure out what the problem foods may be. So it's good, and it's a safe thing to do. There's no harm in it.
So you're saying, here's an example. They talk about a patient, Ms. Katie Collette, a 36-year-old graduate student, who cut gluten, eggs, dairy, soy, peanuts, corn, and sugar out of her diet for 3 weeks, and she was suffering from headaches. Her headaches became less frequent on the diet, and when she brought back soy, even a small amount of edamame, which is the green soybeans, she got a headache and runny nose. So she plans to avoid most soy in the long term. No more tofu for me, she says.
What's interesting? You know, 20, 30 years ago, soy wasn't even on the top allergen list. But because it's been so prevalent in our food supply, I mean, there's soy everywhere. If you read a can of tuna, there's soy in there. Even if you pick up any kind of packaged food, there's some kind of soy content or derivative of soy. It's everywhere. And I think that's why it became an allergen.
Yeah, same thing, I think, with peanuts. Peanuts used to be very uncommon in the American diet, you know, just a staple in the South. Now peanut production has exploded, and everybody's consuming a lot of peanuts. And, you know, sometimes when you rely on foods too much, have them day in and day out, the body develops sensitivity. So, you know, look, obviously this is a big phenomenon. They sometimes refer to it disparagingly as a fad, but more and more people are seeking it out. And I think this concept has really stood the test of time. A lot of people are achieving wellness this way, you know, with skin problems, headaches, mood problems, gastrointestinal problems, joint pain, not just the traditional nasal congestion and asthma, but those problems, of course, too, resolve when you find the right diet. So pretty cool stuff. I mean, like, finally, hey, we finally made it into the mainstream here.
Yay!
We're vindicated. All our work has not been for naught. Good deal.
Yeah.
All right, so let's hear what let's hear what the questions are. And there's this one answer for every question. It's going on an elimination diet. So
right.
We could just conclude this daily podcast.
That's
I'm sure we can
do an elimination diet.
I think we can do better than that. So let's individualize the advice for these questions. What's your first one?
Okay. We have Lorraine emails us. I read that strontium is known to produce false reading in your bone density scans. And can this be a cause of blood clots and other unpleasant results? What is your take on this? I've been on strontium for about 5 years and have seen an improvement in my bone density. Should I continue taking it? Many thanks for your time.
Okay.
Lorraine.
So there are reports from Europe of an increased risk of blood clots. Still a very, very rare phenomenon with the type of prescription strontium that they're using there, which is strontium ranelate, which is an unusual compound of strontium. I think one of the reasons they're using a weird form of strontium is not necessarily because it's superior, because we're getting equivalent results with a much cheaper, non-patented, over-the-counter product in the United States, strontium citrate. I think the reason they're seeing these problems is not because of the strontium per se, but because of the ranelate.
Which is patentable, right?
Which is patentable, yeah. And so, mm-hmm. you know, if it was just strontium citrate, there is no patent on a natural product. I mean, I guess they could try and enforce what's called intellectual property on the use of that, you know, the application of that to the problem of osteoporosis. Mm-hmm. But so we haven't seen any reports of that. None of my patients have certainly had blood clots. And as to the false elevation in bone density, it's actually true that strontium lights up brighter than calcium on a bone scan. So
it illuminates it a little more, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So when we see an improvement, sometimes we see sensational improvements, like 18% in 2 years. That's phenomenal. I actually saw 25% in a patient in 4 years. That's
wow.
Phenomenal improvement. We actually have to cool our jets a little bit. There is a real improvement in bone density, but the improvement is only half of what we see on the bone density test. So there is a little bit of an artificial enhancement of the bone density test. And until recently, most osteoporosis specialists weren't familiar with this. Now, what they can do is they can say, well, okay, it's 10%. That really means 5%. Just do the math, divide it in half.
As long as it's favorable.
Right.
As long as it's favorable on a bone mineral density,
yes.
I think it's terrific.
Well, here's the rub. There are some agents, for example, like fluoride, which you know is a very toxic agent, which actually makes the bone density appear better, but it really doesn't strengthen bone. It actually creates brittle bone. So they don't use fluoride anymore for osteoporosis, nor should they. Mm-hmm. However, the studies.
However, our water is fluoridated. Anyway.
Well, I know, but yeah. that's the point is they don't use really high dose sodium fluoride for bones anymore. But the studies in Europe show that not only does the bone density appearance seem greater on the tests, but it actually translates to a dramatic reduction in both spinal and hip fractures, which is really the name of the game. So, you know, there are many things that can change numbers. For example, there are diabetes medications that can make the blood sugar look better. But if at the end of the day, more patients die of heart attacks as a result of side effects, that's the medication's not doing much good. Even though your numbers look better, but you're dead. That's not good.
Yeah.
So similarly, we don't want a bunch of people with very strong-looking bones that are fragile getting hip fractures. That's not happening with strontium. I'm actually still very satisfied with strontium, and you know we're looking.
We have really excellent case studies with strontium.
Oh my God! It's revolutionized our approach to mm-hmm. osteoporosis and enabled us to use far less in the way of medication. It's very rare. I had one woman the other day who I sent for medication. Her bone density was just so low that I said, I think you need to try both medication and the natural support together. And she had some improvements. So.
Yeah. And you know, that's what happens when you're in your 80s.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I remember her.
So, next question.
All right. Next question we have from Kevin. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Can you recommend a sunscreen for a 6 to 7 month old infant? As summer finally approaches, we plan to spend a good amount of time outside. Okay, here's the deal.
I looked this up, and I know you're going to. We discussed this, but I looked this up, and I said I have a feeling that it's not such a great idea to slather sunscreen on a baby. And that I'm not a pediatrician, but I just said there's something unwholesome about that. And so you tell us the rest,
yeah.
Because when I looked it up, it said, don't even put sunscreen on a child under 6 months. It's not recommended.
It's not recommended. The best recommendation is to keep the child out of the sun.
Yes.
Under a beach umbrella, something like that, fully clothed with a nice rimmed hat, all of that. A 6 month old and under 6 months should not be getting any kind of sunscreen or sunblock because there is the tendency to absorb, and you know, there's the danger of nanoparticles. Microparticle is better than nanoparticles. That's certainly one thing. But over 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, a little older than that, the recommendation is a microparticle type sunscreen or sunblock containing zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. These are actually acting as barriers. They're not necessarily being absorbed into the skin. You don't want the child to absorb all of these chemicals.
And the principle really is that kids are more sensitive, and they also, their skin is thinner. And so you don't want to slather all these chemicals on the kid, because the chemicals will go into the kid. And we as adults should also be cautious about that. But, you know, the old-fashioned sunscreen, when I was growing up, there were two things to put on your skin. One was mineral oil, which doesn't do any good at all, except it makes your skin, you know, shiny. And it actually acts as sort of a lens to make you tan faster.
I did a lot of baby oil when I was,
Doesn't do any good at all. Doesn't do any good at all. Nope. And the other was that, but the lifeguards were smart, because they put like this white streak on their nose. And it was sort of like a cool thing. You know, it's like if you were really cool, you would put that white streak on your nose like the lifeguards did. Because they were like those muscular, you know, that was, remember the days of, what was that lifeguard show called? The one with all the beautiful babes and, you know.
Baywatch.
Baywatch, yeah, Baywatch. Right.
Yeah.
You know, because that in those days, you knew you were a lifeguard if you had like a white stripe down your nose. And that's zinc oxide, good old-fashioned zinc oxide. So with zinc oxide, it's basically zinc. Zinc can be toxic, very high doses, but mostly moderate doses of zinc, even if it gets into your skin, are less likely to cause problems. You know, kids kind of touch stuff and put their fingers in their mouth. So what? It's zinc oxide. Titanium, you mentioned the microparticle distinction versus the nano. See, microparticles are tiny, and they're basically going to give you a white effect on the skin, and they reflect, you know, because they're reflective. But the nanoparticles, they're so small, they can get into the body and they can cause havoc. So I wouldn't go with anything that's nanoparticles.
And you know, the reason they moved to nanoparticles is to get rid of that whitish coating look.
Yeah.
But at what expense? Yeah. No, yeah. Nanoparticles are not a good idea.
And why they give you white skin, or sometimes sheen, is because they're reflective. They're like little tiny microscopic reflectors. And that's actually good, because they will reflect the sun away from your skin without a chemical effect. It's actually more of a physical reflectant effect. Mm-hmm. And that's superior to some sort of chemical effect.
Let's make it fashionable.
Yeah, let's do it again.
On the beach this summer, absolutely.
I say, you know, let's get different colors. I'd like to, maybe we can do like Blue Man Group on the beach.
There you go.
That's a cool look. That's a cool look. I'll dye my hair pink. And I'll put the Blue Man Group sun. But why would I want to do that?
Oh, wow, I just got a visual of that. Okay.
And that's too scary. But, you know, with the turquoise board shorts, that's going to look really good. But,
yeah.
But why, another issue is, why slather all this junk on our skin? Because to some extent, yes, we are preventing skin aging and skin cancer, but we're so courting vitamin D deficiency that is responsible for much more serious diseases like heart disease, diabetes, fibromyalgia, immune problems, and even cancer. So, you know, moderate sun exposure is the key.
Yeah, moderate sun exposure. And, you know, people, because they're told by their dermatologist to avoid, you know, noonday sun, they're told, you know, get a little sun at maybe 10 a.m. and then after 2 or 3 p.m. But the UVB rays happen around lunchtime, between 11 and 1:30, 2 o'clock. So we're meant to go out there, expose as much skin as possible for a good 10 to 30 minutes, depending on your tolerance. We don't want anybody to burn, but we want you to be able to make enough vitamin D in that period of time. That's when the UVB rays are,
you know,
at that angle.
These sun recommendations are the dermatology equivalent of the food pyramid. You know, just like, yeah, interesting concept, but you got it all wrong. You're making huge public health recommendations for tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people based on incomplete science and with tunnel vision. And as a result, you know, you may be addressing one problem, but creating disaster for tens of millions more. So,
and
I think
true.
Let's use.
And you know what else? To add insult to injury, the UVA rays, the sun, you know, the skin damaging rays are out when we're told it's safe to go in the sun at 10 a.m. and after 2 or 3 p.m. And that's exactly what you don't want, because the UVA rays are, yes, damaging, cause aging, wrinkling, but they also will destroy the little amount of vitamin D that you just made earlier. So the time to put on that sunblock sunscreen is during those hours.
Wow, that's an interesting factoid.
Yeah.
So it's the UVB that builds the
The vitamin D
and the UVA may antagonize it. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Interesting.
That's why there's no such thing as ODing on vitamin D via sunlight alone.
Okay.
Nature kind of took care of that for us.
There's a feedback loop on that, mm-hmm, like a thermostat in your home.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yes. Interesting. All right. We have time for one more question before we get to the break of our first part. So,
yes. Speaking of vitamin D.
Yeah.
Actually, we have a question from Joseph. He says, "Hi, Layla. I've been taking vitamin D for years. Always had regular blood tests to make sure I have an adequate amount." He's taking both D2 and D3 between 5,000 and 10,000 units daily, except for the day that he takes the D2, which is a 50,000.
Hmm.
But get this, Dr. Hoffman, his latest test says his total D is 34, his D2 is 18, his D3 is 16.
Okay, so,
or vice versa on those.
So several points on this. First of all, this month, and an article that will be serialized in our newsletter. If you want to get our newsletter, just click on the newsletter. You know, we don't sell our mailing list. We're not going to bombard you with ads. We don't spam you. We just send you factual material. If you want to click on, you know, an announcement for a supplement or something, you can do your search on your own. But the newsletter this month, you haven't seen my article yet, but it's the top 12 drugs that you would like to avoid. And it includes vitamin D2, which is commonly prescribed now for people with vitamin D deficiency. It goes by various names. I think
ergocalciferol.
Ergocalciferol is the generic. It goes by different brand names. Drizdol is one of them. And that is a vitamin D2. For the life of me, I don't understand why they still make vitamin D2. I think it's a cost factor. Or maybe a
patent.
Did
they find a way to patent this or something?
Yeah, probably. I mean, vitamin D2 comes from mushrooms that are irradiated, and vitamin D3 comes from lanolin. I think we went over this in a recent podcast.
Yeah.
And vitamin D3 is far more bioavailable and bioactive than vitamin D2. And actually, vitamin D2, in addition to being less bioactive than vitamin D3, it cancels out the effects of vitamin D3 to some extent. So really, you want to minimize your D2. It'd be nice if his vitamin D, what was the number? It was 32?
The total was 34.
34. So it'd be nice if it was 34, and 34 out of 34 was vitamin D3. The D2 doesn't help very much.
No.
And
apparently it's canceling it out because his D3 is either 18 or 16, according to this. One of these is a D2, the other is a D3. I think there's a typo here.
It should summate to, you know, the D2 plus the D3 equals the total D. So, but the effectiveness is diminished by the D2. I mean, not that it's totally worthless. It's just less efficient, you know. So if you want to put...
I would advise he stop taking the D2 altogether.
Right.
Would you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, if he needs to take that 50,000, we don't sell it.
It should be D3.
It should be D3. We give this to our patients individually. We don't really want to sell it on the internet because people might get a little carried away, and I don't want to be responsible for people overdosing on vitamin D. I think vitamin D at 50,000 should probably be dispensed by healthcare practitioners and not just available so people can take it willy-nilly, because people screw up. They get overzealous, and with 50,000, you can get into trouble. Not so much with 5,000s. It's hard to OD on 5,000s unless you get really nuts about it. But with 50,000s, if you take it day in and day out, you can't get into trouble.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So, okay, this is a logical place for a break. We usually split our podcasts into two segments. Consider this the first. We'll continue in just a moment with part two of our weekly Q&A with Layla, and we'll be answering more of your questions. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.